damage, that he was just doing his job. It's extremely concerning that he's being charged, and even more concerning that he's being charged with a hate crime. And it's concerning that all of these people are being prosecuted for hate crimes, because it is an absolute misuse of the hate crimes legislation, and again, an exploitation of the law, which is not new, unfortunately, in this country, as we all know very well, an exploitation of the law to prosecute the most vulnerable in favor of the most powerful. And in this case, it's very stark.
Lena Widdy is attorney for Samuel Seligson, a New York City-based journalist charged with felony hate crime for allegedly filming pro-Palestinian activists hurling red paint at the homes of top officials at the Brooklyn Museum. Seligson's work has appeared in Reuters, Al Jazeera, ABC, and Fox News. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for director of development, support our fundraising efforts, and an archives intern to support our archives team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
Do you love music but don't have the energy to find new stuff? Can't decide whether you want to hear indie rock or hip-hop, electronic music or singer-songwriters? Then tune into Another Late Night every first Saturday at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Community Radio, or stream online at kboo.fm/anotherlatenight, where we've got it all.
The 2024 election is coming, and we at KBOO want to make sure your voice is heard. Take KBOO's Election Agenda Survey and help our volunteer reporters and programmers cover the 2024 election. We want to know, what do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Fill out our survey by August 14th, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card. Full rules on our website. At the end of August, we'll report back with the community's priorities. Find that survey online at bit.ly/KBOOSurvey2024. That's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey24.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon wildfires reached the metro area with evacuations near Canby.
Workers at Do Good Multnomah file for a union election.
And Portland General Electric files for yet another rate increase.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 9th, 2024. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. A wildfire near Canby has closed Highway 99E south of Oregon City. The fire also prompted evacuation notices east of the highway, including Level 3 Go Now evacuations along South End Road, north to Reflection Lane. Traffic along the Willamette River in the area is limited, as fire crews need access to water. People seeking shelter can go to Gardner Middle School in Oregon City, and they can take livestock to the Washington County Fairgrounds. Other fires throughout Oregon have also prompted evacuation notices, such as the Crazy Creek and Lee Falls fires. The Crazy Creek fire is located southeast of Mitchell and has grown to nearly 80,000 acres as of this morning. It is currently 50% contained. There was an increase in fire behavior across the eastern flank of the fire Tuesday afternoon, likely due to critically low humidity levels. Mandatory evacuation orders remain in effect for areas in Crook and Wheeler counties, with level 3 evacuations extending from the forest boundary to Highway 380. The conditions remain challenging for firefighters, as the forecast predicts hot and dry weather will persist for some time. Firefighters are also fighting the Lee Falls Fire, located southwest of Forest Grove. As of yesterday evening, the fire was estimated to cover 200 acres and was 0% contained. The Washington County Sheriff's Office issued a Level 3 evacuation notice for the city of Cherry Grove, about 28 miles west of downtown Portland. People in the area are advised to leave immediately. The evacuation order also extends to people living along Southwest Oak Street and Southwest Nixon Drive in Gaston. The acreage burned has already set a new Oregon record.
Workers at Do Good Multnomah asked their employer for voluntary recognition of their union on Thursday. Do Good is one of the county contractors tasked with running shelters and housing programs and operates out of nearly a dozen sites in the Portland area. Their services include emergency shelter, on-site housing support, case management, and other veteran-specific services. According to a statement issued yesterday by the statewide branch of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, a strong majority of Do Good Multnomah's 270 eligible workers signed union cards. That includes shelter, housing, case management, and behavioral health workers. According to AFSCME, if management refuses to recognize the union, the signed cards will be submitted to the National Labor Relations Board, which will trigger a binding election. The announcement comes after workers submitted a State Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration, or OSHA, complaint against Do Good because of hazards at its downtown shelter in the old Greyhound station. According to reporting by Willamette Week, the anonymous complaint alleges that Do Good subjected about 16 workers and dozens of residents to excessive heat conditions with no space for recovery from symptoms during the July heat wave.
A new law will make it easier for Washingtonians to register to vote online if they don't have a driver's license. The law comes from a bill passed in 2023 that went into effect on July 15th, just in time for this year's primary election earlier this week. Under the new law, people can register to vote with the last four digits of their Social Security number and an uploaded photo of their signature. Abigail Leong with the Washington Voting Justice Coalition says this gives greater access to voting for people who don't have licenses.
The people least likely to have a Washington driver's license are young voters, Black and Latino voters, people with low incomes, recent citizens, maybe people even just who recently moved and haven't switched their driver's license over.
Leong says online voter registration is becoming increasingly popular, and so this change helps the state prepare for that. The online registration's deadline to vote in the general election is October 28th. If Washingtonians miss that date, they can still register in person anytime before 8 p.m. on Election Day, November 5th. Jasmine Smith is with the Washington Bus, a youth voting organization. She says it's exciting to see the state of Washington to continue to ensure more people can vote.
We're adopting the technology we need and making voter access as streamlined, easy, and accessible as possible.
Leong says there are real-world benefits of accessible online voter registration. She notes one case in which a person with disabilities had moved recently and their new apartment wasn't getting them their mail.
They had to register in person at a site that wasn't accessible to people with mobility aids. And it was during COVID and they're immunocompromised, so it was extra hard for them. So it's really helpful for people like that who might have no other way to register to vote without a lot of trouble.
That was Abigail Leong from Washington Voting Justice Coalition.
Portland General Electric, or PGE, wants to raise rates by nearly 11% for all customers in 2025. PGE initially asked the Oregon Public Utility Commission for a 7.4% increase in March, but revised the number in July. If the new request is approved, it would be the third straight year PGE has increased its rates. PGE's rates have already gone up by over 40% since 2021, with an 18% increase in 2024 alone. The planned rate increases come at a time when PGE is shutting off power to more households than ever, with over 4,000 households cut off in April and 4,000 more in May. These cutoffs are largely due to individuals' inability to keep up with the cost of electricity bills. Bob Jenks is the head of the consumer advocacy group Oregon Citizens Utility Board. He said, quote, "Oregon families are already struggling to afford their energy bills. We need our utilities to control their spending. No one should have to choose between electricity and food, medicine, or other necessities. But this is what PGE is effectively asking too many people to do with seemingly unending requests for double-digit bill increases," end quote. PGE spokeswoman Sarah Hamaker said, quote, "We recognize that rate increases are challenging for our customers. As we modernize and strengthen the grid, PGE is focused on keeping the cost of electricity as affordable as possible," end quote. She also stated that no number is final and that PGE continues to work alongside stakeholders. The Oregon Citizens Utility Board is accepting public comment through August 27th. Electricity rates increases are not exclusive to PGE, as Pacific Power sent in a request July 26th to increase their rates by nearly 12%. PGE and Pacific Power cover a combined 1.5 million customers across Oregon.
The Multnomah County Animal Shelter is still not doing a good job of using public donations to care for animals, according to a report released today by county auditors. 1 year after finding the shelter had failed to spend more than $2 million in public and county funds, auditors say that spending has increased, but not in the right ways. Several funds that are made up of public donations and are earmarked for specific purposes are being used in ways that are contrary to guidelines set by the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. For example, instead of using a spay and neuter fund to help low-income pet owners pay for surgeries, the shelter is using it to provide vouchers for pets adopted without being altered, a practice that is inconsistent with national standards and which has fueled criticism from community advocates. The report also found that spending from an adoption outreach fund had increased significantly, but most of the money was being used to pay the six-figure salary of the communications coordinator. That position was previously paid out of the general fund. It is not clear how much impact this new report will have on a shelter that has years of well-documented issues around money management, care and treatment of animals, adoption policies, and staff retention. Selena Cruz, the county's chief operating officer, was dismissive of the findings, writing in a memo that the shelter, quote, "does and should continue to preserve and use donation funds in accordance with each fund's intended purpose," end quote.
A mighty oak has fallen, so say the friends and family of Portland activist Joe Keating, who died August 4th. An activist's activist, Joe's life was dedicated to making communities better through people power. Joe and his friend Tom Flynn formed an organization called UCAN, fighting successfully for stormwater rebates for elders. They also created and installed warning signs for anglers on the Willamette River, warning of the toxic danger of eating bottom feeding fish in multiple languages aimed at the communities who fish there the most. In the mid-1990s, Joe led the Action Resource Team, which offered support to activists fighting old-growth logging under the Salvage Logging Rider, signed into law by former President Bill Clinton. Art provided everything from action organizing to police negotiation, legal support, and media. He was a pacifist who brought thousands of people together over the years for protests, including direct action against the U.S. Navy battleships that cruised into Portland for the Rose Festival. Most notably, UCAN Jump started the Yellow Bike Project that left free bikes around town for anyone to use. It was a disaster, but it captured the imagination of the entire city. It was the nation's first example of a bike share program. Joe is described as the best boss, captain, visionary, cheerleader, colleague, and provocateur that one could find. He is survived by his partner, Kathy Geiger, daughter Cricket, and sons, Ted and Peter. He was 81 years old. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Joe's friend, Steve Gunther, today.
What do you think is the most important thing for people living in Portland today to know about Joe Keating and his work?
Convivitas. It's a word he coined that means coexistence, harmony, community. It's very ambitious to try to add a word to our language and request that it become, or hope that it becomes common use. And that's who he was. He had that kind of ambition.
Say it one more time.
convivitas, as a greeting, salutation. You know, we can. I think it's a spirit. It's whatever we can make it positive.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving with Steve Gunther today.
Vice Presidential hopeful Walz makes a fiery defense in Wisconsin as his state Supreme Court upholds a voting rights measure. Utah enacts a controversial book ban. A poll reveals doubts about democracy's future. And renewable energy funding could be at risk. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I don't need you telling me about our health care. I don't need you telling us who we love. And I sure the hell don't need you telling us what books we're going to read.
Vice Presidential hopeful Governor Tim Walz pushing back against Republican attacks. Walz and Vice President Kamala Harris are holding rallies across Wisconsin and Michigan, with Republican nominee J.D. Vance headlining counter rallies in both states. The Ohio senator is attacking the Democrats as extremists, while the Minnesota governor argues their positions on abortion, gay marriage, and censorship are actually closer to the mainstream. In an unusual hour-long press conference, former President Donald Trump confirmed an ABC debate with Harris in a month and proposed additional debates on NBC and Fox. Former Trump spokesman Anthony Scaramucci told MSNBC he thinks Trump is unraveling.
This is all him telling you that he's now frightened, he's now cornered, and he's very angry.
Meanwhile, Utah has enacted a ban on 13 books, ordering works by Judy Blume and Margaret Atwood removed from public schools and libraries. PEN America calls this the first statewide book ban. But Corinne Johnson, president of Utah Parents United, supports the ban.
Children had access to this content without parental consent, and now those books are being removed so that our libraries are age-appropriate.
On Wednesday, the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld a law restoring voting rights to people with prison records. The court focused on procedural issues rather than the substance of the 2023 legislation. But State Attorney General Keith Ellison says he's glad the court is providing clarity for the nearly 60,000 newly eligible voters.
Watch what's going on in Florida. You know, people there thought they had the right to vote, and the governor there ordered that some of them be arrested, even though they thought and had a good faith basis to believe that they could vote.
A recent AP poll shows only a fifth of U.S. adults believe democracy will endure after the 2024 election. Many are discouraged by the race between Harris and Trump, with another 20% saying democracy is too broken to matter. Clean energy groups say they're concerned about what the election could mean for renewable projects. Lisa Abel with the Yellow Springs Development Corporation says she's afraid even previously passed bipartisan funding agreements could be overturned.
If there were a new administration, those funds are definitely at risk, even though they were set up for a 10-year disbursement. Anything can happen, anything can be canceled.
And finally, an Ohio proposal to change how the state draws legislative and congressional districts has raised a record $27 million. This fall, Ohio voters will decide whether to keep the current lawmaker-run system or switch to a 15-member independent citizen redistricting commission. The group backing the plan says it has raised the most ever for an Ohio ballot measure. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy with a low of 75 degrees. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 86 degrees. Today in history, in 1965, Singapore is expelled from Malaysia and becomes the only country to date to gain independence unwillingly. The quote of the day is from American track and field athlete Jesse Owens, who won 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympic Games. He said, quote, "Find the good. It's all around you. Find it, showcase it, and you'll start believing in it." Thank you.
Indigenous advocates are laying out their next steps following a federal report on Indian boarding schools. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new federal Indian boarding school report found nearly 1,000 children died while attending the schools created to strip them of their culture. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
The report identified nearly 19,000 children who attended a boarding school between 1819 and 1969. But the government acknowledges there were more. At the schools, teachers were known to do everything from cutting students' hair to beating them for speaking their native languages. This investigation, led by the Interior Department, found marked and unmarked graves at 65 different school sites. The agency says it's working with tribes that want remains repatriated. Stacy Larvey is Ponca and a member of a National Tribal Historic Preservation Group. She urges the government to focus on
coming up with solutions and ways to heal the trauma. And one part of apologizing or acknowledging would be future investments into tribal nations.
In fact, the report recommends the U.S. provides funding for culturally based programs centered on intergenerational trauma, violence prevention, and revitalizing Native languages.
For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Research from the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition shows that by the 1920s, there were more than 60,000 children in the schools. The Federal Communications Commission voted this week to establish a new alert code for missing and endangered people by delivering messages to the public over TV, radio, and wireless phones. The alert code will help law enforcement agencies draw public attention to missing people of all ages who do not qualify for Amber Alerts. According to the FCC, the decision will support efforts to raise public awareness of missing Indigenous people. The Southern Ute, Ute Mountain Ute, and Ute tribes recently gathered for their annual friendly sports competition for young people. Clark Adamitis has more.
At the Ignacio High School Gymnasium, young people from three tribes are playing volleyball against each other at the annual Tri-Ute Games. This year, the Southern Ute Tribe is hosting its sister tribes, the Ute Mountain Ute and Ute Indian tribes, in Ignacio, Colorado. Other sports taking place throughout the three-day gathering include archery, skateboarding, and hand games. Kaya Whiteskunk is the recreation director for the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe. She says that the three sister tribes gathering for this annual event shows unity.
Maybe we have relatives from the other tribes that we don't get to see, but this is a time that it helps the youth get to know each other.
Over at the Southern Ute Bear Dance Trail, athletes in colored shirts are running the Ute Warrior Challenge.
We're almost there. We're almost there. Just, good job there. Good job.
Darnell Muniz is a recreation specialist at the Sun Ute Community Center. He's guiding kids running along the road after they just slid through a slip and slide.
The challenge is having them running about half a mile on our Bear Dance Trail. And then there at the park, we have various events, like army crawl, slip and slide.
Eunice says that this year's Tri-Ute Games was the first one since the COVID-19 pandemic with all three tribes. In 2022, the games only included two of the three sister tribes.
They still had the temperature checks and also mask mandate still, so at that time, there wasn't that many participants.
This year, the Southern Ute and Ute Indian tribes opened up youth registration to second descendants of tribal members. Over 300 youth athletes participated this year. Next year's Tri-Ute Games will likely be hosted by the Ute Indian tribe in Fort Duchesne, Utah. I'm Clark Adamitis.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A U.S. Senate investigation has revealed alarming rates of abuse of pregnant women in prisons, including in Georgia. Recent hearing testimony focused on severe mistreatment, prompting calls for policy changes to protect their rights and health of mothers behind bars and their newborns. Shantia Hudson reports.
A U.S. Senate subcommittee has uncovered widespread abuse of pregnant and postpartum women incarcerated nationwide, including in Georgia. Senator John Ossoff, the Georgia Democrat who chairs the Senate Subcommittee on Human Rights and the Law, says their research has found more than 200 reported cases of human rights violations against women in state prisons and jails. He says the abuses range from neglect during labor to newborns being taken away immediately after birth.
We've heard from mothers forced to give birth in prison showers, hallways, or on dirty cell floors. Mothers who gave birth into toilets after being told they were not in labor.
Despite laws in 41 states, including Georgia, that prohibit or restrict shackling pregnant and postpartum people in prison, the subcommittee says violations were found in at least 16 states. During last week's hearing, Jessica Umberger, who gave birth in a Georgia state prison, testified about the abuse she endured. She recounted being forced to have a cesarean section and said she was denied proper hygiene and placed in solitary confinement shortly after the birth.
I was put in solitary when my baby was only 5 days old. In solitary confinement, I had no medical support. The staples in my stomach from my C-section had not dissolved, and there was no air conditioner.
The senators also heard from Dr. Carolyn Suffren, who teaches at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She suggested changes to address mistreatment and improve conditions for those who are pregnant behind bars.
There are many opportunities for policy and practice change that could improve conditions and the well-being of pregnant and postpartum women in prisons and jails, as well as for their newborns. One is to find a pathway to require medical standards of care.
She says expanding Medicaid to cover people in prison could help enforce these standards. Senator Ossoff stressed the need for bipartisanship and said further investigation is needed. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson.
New standards have been approved for livestock carrying the USDA Certified Organic label, although it'll be a while before they are required. Those raising livestock will have to observe the new standards by January 2029 at the latest. Sentient Science reporter Seth Milstein says some of the changes under the new standards may surprise shoppers who choose certified organic meat and poultry out of concern for the animals.
There were various procedures that were just flat out banned in the new standards. Tail docking of cows and gestation crates and farrowing cages for pigs or toe clipping chickens. This is stuff that animal welfare activists have been pushing for a while.
Milstein stresses these standards affect only producers with the USDA organic certification, which is voluntary. Among the categories are the amount of indoor and outdoor space required, poultry stocking densities, and physical alterations and euthanasia. Some 40,000 written comments were submitted during the USDA's public comment period for the new standards. Milstein maintains that certifications by the nonprofits A Greener World and Certified Humane reveal more about how the animals were raised than the USDA certification.
If you want to shop consciously with a mind towards animal welfare approved is generally recognized as the most stringent, the highest standards for the animals. Certified Humane is good as well. It's not quite as good, but good.
Milstein says labels can be confusing and even misleading and encourages people who rely on them to do some research. He points to egg labels as a prime example.
Some of them are regulated by law. Some of them are not. Interesting case is pasture raised, which has no legal regulations and essentially means nothing, except if it says certified humane pasture raised, that's a very high standard. Cage-free eggs, there's like three different certifications for that.
That was Sentient Science reporter Seth Milstein.
The Paris Olympics are drawing to a close. With all the updates, it's Grant Button with KBOO Sports News.
As the Olympics are coming to a close, the U.S. is tied for the most gold medals at 33, with a huge lead in total medals, 28 to be exact. One of the 33 gold medals belongs to Olivia Reeves, who took part in the women's weightlifting 71 kilogram division. She lifted a whopping 577 pounds over her head on her way to becoming the U.S.'s first Olympic gold medal weightlifter since 2000. Thank goodness she didn't have to jump with the weight like Rye Benjamin, who won gold for the U.S. in the men's 400-meter hurdles, beating out his opponents by over half a second. This follows Sydney McLaughlin-Levrone's world record run on Thursday for the women's 400-meter hurdles, making it the second time the U.S. has swept both events. Moving to the court, the U.S. has dominated in both men's and women's basketball, both of whom will have to face off against France in the finals. The men's team barely got past Serbia and Nikola Jokic yesterday in the semifinal, overcoming a 17-point deficit to sneak out a win by four. Steph Curry was money from beyond the arc, scoring 36 crucial points, and Joel Embiid drilled 8 shots over Jokic to propel the U.S. to the gold medal game. The men's team will face off against France and Victor Wembanyama tomorrow at 12:30. On the women's side, the U.S. crushed Australia 85-64 today in the semifinals, with Brianna Stewart leading the team with 16 points, 5 assists, and 6 rebounds. They will also be playing France for gold at the early hour of 6:30 on Sunday. For KBOO Sports News, I'm Grant Button.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 9th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Grant Button, Jasmine Moss, Lisa Loving, and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Alex Gonzalez, and Shantaya Hudson. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our wonderful members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Happy Friday. Stay tuned for Counterspin.